I'm live?
I'm live. All right.
Oh, boy.
Check for polls. See y'all later. All right, folks, welcome to our next panel on the FF Forums here. It's called Low Power to the People. Originally, this panel was supposed to be run by Johnny X, who ditched out early today to head back to Nashville. And let me introduce myself. First of all, my name is Laughing Boy. I'm affiliated with the Southeastern chapter of 2600 here, as most of us are. About a year ago, year and a half ago, I was a low-power FM applicant. I filed all the paperwork and crossed my T's and dotted my I's, figured out the telemetry and the coordinates of my antenna site. I applied for the low-power FM license with the FCC. For those of you that might not know, a couple years ago, the FCC instituted the low-power FM initiative, and in doing that, basically they were going to grant low-power FM licenses to community groups, nonprofit groups, churches, and local cities to do local traffic reports, school closings, basically a community radio station for a particular locale. They were going to come in two flavors. There was going to be a 10-watt license and a 100-watt license. And while that doesn't sound like a lot of power, I mean, you hear about radio stations. 40,000 watts of FM power. Believe it or not, 100 watts or even 10 watts or even 1 watt, if you have your transmitter and antenna in a strategic location, you can reach a really surprising large footprint of coverage with just a little bit of power. So the FCC was going to grant these licenses, and there was the potential where there were going to be thousands of new independently run radio stations across the country being run by people just like me and you. If you wanted to, they weren't going to make licenses available to individuals, but there were a couple of loopholes around that. Number one, I'm an ordained minister from an online minister. The Universal Life Church, ulc.org. You go on their website and you type in your name and basically click ordain me, and boom, you're ordained electronically over the internet. And being as such, you can establish your own church, your own nonprofit organization, and this was going to be my shoe in, my foot in the door into my own low-power FM radio station. Everything was fine and great, and they accepted my application. The frequency that I chose, nobody else in my area was competing for that frequency, so I was like, yes, this is great. I'm going to have my own low-power FM radio station, 100 watts. And unfortunately, the corporate entity known as the National Association of Broadcasters, NAB, which is such an appropriate acronym for this agency. Basically, they saw, wait a second, there's a potential here for people to like really start competing with us and taking away advertising dollars from us. I mean, maybe these radio stations are actually going to start playing something interesting aside from the top 40 drivel that we're shoveling down everyone else's throats. And they started to panic, and they said, what can we do? Okay, we need to enact the Radio Preservation Act of, was it 1999 or 2000? Radio Preservation Act. Basically, they were saying these radio stations, as such, the original proposal for low-power FM was, let's say you have a radio station at 96.6 FM. The next available slot for you to put a low-power FM radio station on, I think, was two adjacents. So from 96.6 FM, the next available adjacent would be 97, I believe is how it was supposed to work. It was either one or two adjacents. And they said, that's too close. These stations are going to cause interference on our stations. And they went so far as to produce this utterly fraudulent recording that they played for Congress, this is what low-power FM radio station interference is going to sound like if there are only two adjacents over. And it was completely fraudulent. They played this for members of Congress, and there were members of Congress that were like, oh, gosh, we can't have that. There's, you know, this is interference with existing commercially established radio stations. And I don't fault the members of Congress for this. I think it was a case of ignorance on their part. But the FCC came back and said, no, this isn't the type of interference you would get. At worst, the amount of interference you would be getting would be a little bit of phase cancellation. You know how sometimes you'll hear a station drift in and out a little bit? The station would be completely, you know, audible, but the tape that they had played for, I heard an MP3 of it on the FCC's website. It was a complete joke. I mean, they were in essence saying you're not going to be able to hear anything when one of these radio stations is running. So basically they said, okay, we're not totally, this is the NAB, we're not totally opposed to the low power FM initiative, but we want it three adjacents over. Well, the FM dial is very, very crowded. I mean, even in rural areas now, to find an open frequency three adjacents over is, you have to go out in the sticks. You really do. And basically, there are the low power FM initiative is still going forward, and I think there have already been a couple of stations that have had the permit to construct their station. But we're talking stations that are out in the middle of nowhere, okay? And they're going to hit a listening audience of, you know, 5 or 10 people probably. So really what happened, the NAB, they managed to get their legislation snuck in as a rider on a completely unrelated bill. You know, this drives me nuts. I mean, where is the line item veto where the president can say, what does this have to do with the rest of this? They stuck it in on a, I think it was like a budget bill. I can't remember what the bill was that they managed to sneak this legislation past Congress and even got the president's signature on it, enacting it into law. But they don't have, you know, again, I don't cite Congress. They don't have time to go over every single, you know, piece of a bill, and this is the way things are done in Washington. Unfortunately, it's sneaky, it's a dirty trick, and you know I don't agree with it. I wish that the line item veto was available, because Bill Clinton was a big supporter of the low power FM movement. But I believe what happened was he probably looked at the bill as a whole and said, okay, you know, there's some good legislation in here. I can't veto this because this really needs to be passed. Or maybe, you know, maybe he didn't read the whole thing. Maybe he didn't even realize it. But to make a long story short, the Radio Preservation Act was passed into law, I believe it was last November or December, and that essentially killed about 99% of all of the low-power applications that were already in existence. And severely limited the number of people that are going to get on the air because of this. And to be perfectly honest, this is one reason I was really hoping that Johnny X was here. I got really bitter about the whole thing, and I distanced myself from it completely for about the last 7 or 8 months. I haven't really read up anything more on it, because the more I think about it, the more it infuriates me. Thinking that I was so close, and then to have the NAB babies crying and get their way like a spoiled little child really doesn't sit very well with me. Johnny X did type up some handouts here. I think he said these are basically the same thing as we were handing out last year. And you know, I just, that's basically where I stand with it. It ended, my dreams ended late last year, and I've not really been studying up a whole lot on it since then. Does anybody have any comments or anything they'd like to say about it? I know there are. I know you want to say something. Please help me out here. Yes.
The feeling that I got when the FCC first opened up portions of the bandwidth in the first place was that they were kind of giving piecemeal little breadcrumbs, probably in the hopes of dividing the low power community. It seemed to me like the FCC wasn't going anywhere near as far as they should have in the first place, and they were just kind of trying to assuage the more vehement.
Well, I see your point on that comment. I don't know the inner workings of the FCC. I do know that they are a government agency, and they really are not, from what I can gather, they really aren't friends, buddy buddies with the NAB. Basically, they're a government agency, and as such, yes, maybe there are the kickbacks there. There probably are.
I don't know what their motivation is, but historically, don't seem to really be friends of low power radio.
Yeah, and well. That was the cool thing was that they were. I think William Kennard, Kennard, the director of the FCC, instigated this. A couple years ago, and he started asking people, is there any interest in starting your own community radio station? And of course, there was a resounding yes, and they pushed forward with this. For the FCC themselves to have gone out of their way to produce the real tape showing what actual low-power FM interference, if it even occurred, would sound like, really, to me, led me to believe that they were really fighting for the little guy in this instance. I think from their standpoint is they're looking at it in terms of, okay, there are all these pirates that are going on the air right now. If we can give these people the opportunity to get on the air themselves, maybe, our efforts to try and enforce this and crack down on pirate radio will go down. And indeed, it seemed like that was the case. I mean, I looked around on the internet, and a lot of radio pirates were saying, "My gosh, I'm going to finally be legit." And of course, once the entire thing was killed, I think a lot of them went back to the pirate radio aspect of things and decided to okay, my dreams of ever having my own radio station are gone. Back to business as usual. So,
do you think that their motivation in doing it was in order to be able to get more of the pirate stations under their control?
Probably, that's quite possible. There's all sorts of different ways you can look at that. Again, I would never even dream of running a pirate radio station where I live, because I live about 4 miles away from the FCC's Southeast Enforcement Office, okay? I'm literally within earshot of these guys. They hop in the car, they could be over at my house in 5 minutes. It's a five-minute drive. This is the second year that we've done this panel. Last year, we were going to try and get an FCC agent in here to comment on it. This was when the initiative was still going forward. And I actually went over to their office, and they said it used to actually be a department office. Now it is strictly an enforcement office there. They don't even have a secretary at the front desk. I actually met the director of the office. He and I sat there and chatted for, I can't even remember his name. He and I sat there and chatted for a good half hour, and I told him, what was going on. This is Dragon Con. It's a science fiction and fantasy convention, but it's also becoming, more of almost a popular culture convention. It's an annual event that happens in Atlanta, and we have a track called the Electronic Frontiers, and we're doing a panel on low power FM. We'd love it if you could send somebody down here, to talk with us about what's going on with the low-power FM movement. And he got really, really nervous and almost jittery talking about it, the low-power FM. So maybe what you say does have some semblance. now that I think about it, he was like, well, we've been told that the whole low-power FM thing is something that we're really not even supposed to comment on. He said, you know, it's moving, the bill is moving through Congress right now, and he said, I don't know that we could even, you know, we could give you any insight. But I think more so than anything, their reluctance to participate last year was the fact that it is an enforcement office, and they've shut down a large number of pirate radio stations. And he said point blank to me, he said, you know, we could potentially get ourselves into a very embarrassing situation if some of these pirates are out there in the audience and start heckling us. So,
and they would have been.
Yes, they probably would have been. No. Sounds like the voice of experience coming here.
Well, I've never actually been personally involved with pirate radio, but I was very good friends with someone who was. And
yeah.
So.
Well, we did in fact have a few people in the audience last year that admitted that they were pirates and former pirates. So, yes, the agency would have probably come under extreme fire and scrutiny. And that could have been really
absolutely
interesting. It's kind of a bummer that they didn't send somebody down. But any other questions, comments?
Yeah, I was just curious. I mean, 100 megahertz, I mean, you're not talking about a lot of power.
100 watts.
100 watts, sorry. 100 watts, you're talking about, what, a short little neighborhood area that you could even broadcast from?
Well, the thing is, it depends on where you place your antenna.
Right.
If you are on a flat surface, like you're out in the middle of like Iowa or someplace where you have wide open fields where it's very level geography, you would be amazed at how far a 100-watt signal can reach. You're not talking about a whole lot of power with 100 watts, obviously. You're talking about, you know, maybe the amount of electricity consumed by a light bulb. But, you know, so if you're in hilly terrain, those radio waves won't make it necessarily down into the valleys as much. That's why these larger radio stations kick out, you know, 40,000 watts of power. They want the coverage in these areas that maybe don't get as strong of a signal. You would be amazed at how far a 100 watt signal will reach. The FCC's official their official word on it was that a 100-watt signal should be able to reach about 5.6 miles away from the antenna site, and that's, I laughed when I read that. I said, oh, that would be bad coverage. I've heard of people reaching 40 miles away with a 100-watt signal. Even a 10-watt signal can reach 20 miles. It depends on where you place the antenna. If you place the antenna higher up, obviously the radio waves can spread out more and you can increase your coverage area. The way they were going to get around that was they were going to, you know, you had to give the geographical location of your antenna site, and you had to say what you also had to figure what your elevation above sea level was. And they would say, okay, if your antenna is placed this high, you can only be pushing 100 watts. So it was 100 watts maximum, but they would taper that off accordingly to make sure that you weren't broadcasting out and, you know, going 40, 50 miles out. I think it's really interesting because if you're dealing with suddenly thousands and thousands of new radio stations out there, it could have potentially been a nightmare for them to try and enforce. Because I'm thinking, you know, okay, the FCC comes out and inspects my transmitter site and everything is okay, and they sign off on it, and there goes the agent driving away. Okay, let's crank up the antenna mast a little bit higher up there, you know. And, you know, who are they to say? You know, radio waves, it's not, they really, even FM, which they say doesn't skip off of the ionosphere like AM radio waves do, they do skip to some extent. I used to work at an FM radio station in northern Wisconsin, and FM radio, the school of thought is that the curvature of the Earth the radio signals, the waves are generally only good for about 65 to 75 miles, and then the curvature of the Earth happens, and the FM radio waves travel straight out into space, and you lose your coverage at 65 to 75 miles. That does not always happen. My parents, who lived 120 miles away from this radio station, from the antenna site, frequently picked me up. It wasn't an everyday occurrence, and the signal wasn't, you know, crystal clear, although my dad did say a couple of times it came in, it sounded like it was right next to the antenna site, the radio waves do, FM waves do, as I understand, and I'm not a radio engineer, but I've been told that they do have some, you can get some skip off of the ionosphere and some reflections from natural causes for the FM signal. But, yeah, we have a comment here.
Thanks. I wanted to ask if the FCC director you were talking about has now been rotated out with the new administration, if you know.
I don't know. Is Kennard still there? Is he?
I think Kennard is out because he was the very liberal-minded
yeah.
one that was in there. I think
I
the one that
say.
Bush put in is a, it's a woman. I forget her name, and I don't think she's very open to the idea of LPFM.
Of course not.
One other
Gee,
question.
Surprise.
One other question real quick, and a different subject is, what do you think digital radio is going to do to some of this? Is this going to open the dial up more?
You know, that's really interesting. That's a really interesting aspect there. For those of you who don't know, if you're broadcasting on the FM band and instead of using analog, you go digital, in the 88 to 107 megahertz range of the audio spectrum, you can potentially fit thousands upon thousands of radio stations in that spectrum there. And, you know, the potential is there that...
They lose their excuse at the very least.
Exactly. I really haven't read up a whole lot on that to see where it's going. But that's our next saving grace because low power FM is for all practical purposes for you and I to get on the airwaves is dead. I mean, for them to kill the Radio Preservation Act. Would almost take an act of God. I mean, once something becomes legislation, it is almost impossible for them to do a 180 on it.
So maybe in about 10 years we've got another round?
Maybe.
It's not too far.
And, of course, you know, there's always the idea of, you know, doing internet radio. I mean, what does it take to throw together a shoutcast server or a real audio server? Hardly anything. The only thing you really need is the bandwidth for your multiple connections, but you can potentially reach a global audience, which you're never going to do with 100 watts of FM. Of course, the catch there is you have to be tied into the internet. You have to have a computer. But with the proliferation of wireless devices, this may not always be the case. You know, if you can get local coverage to like a PDA, and your PDA has sound capabilities, you know, you could be roaming around picking up an FM, or I don't want to say an FM, but an internet radio broadcast over the airwaves. You know, think of the way a cell phone gives you roaming, and your PDA having internet wireless internet connectivity. So as you roam, essentially, you know, it may not even be contingent on the FM radio dial anymore. It may be, you know, how many internet radio stations can you fit on the internet? How many millions? You know, basically, the key there, the problem at that point becomes the competition because you're going against thousands and thousands of other potential, you know, competitors. Whereas with low-power FM, you know, the cool thing about that was they were only giving out a limited number of licenses, so it was going to be relatively simple to get a listening base. You know, something new, you know, is coming along in your neighborhood, and you know, you get a write-up in the local newspaper, and people, you know, will go to check you out. I mean, there's so many radio stations right now, as it is on the internet, that you know, I mean, the competition is pretty fierce to get listeners. So, your comment.
I had more of a clarification. Just, I'm assuming most people in here are pretty much familiar with the you know, basics of radio, but just, you know, just so they won't get confused at all, if there are any people who aren't, you know, the tropospheric skip and the ground wave propagation of the radio wave is really not, you know, anything to do with modulation. It's not AM or FM. It's a matter of, we're talking about VHF waves and versus,
right,
you know, very low frequency. And so it's liable to be very unusual for that to happen at FM frequencies in the you know, around 100 megahertz.
Yeah.
Unless you have like a really high sunspot activity, which we did have for a while now.
Yeah.
And so then you might see something strange like that happen, but it's
like
almost
I said,
unheard
of. It was a pretty rare thing.
Yeah.
But you know, be 120, 130 miles away from the antenna site and picking me up loud and clear.
It could have been ducting of some kind. Sometimes there'd be a temporary thing. I was thinking about that, but
I'm not a radio engineer.
Yeah.
I'm not a radio engineer.
I'm just very basically into ham radio, and that's basically where I get this from. But
yeah,
it seems to me like you'd be better off. I mean, well, in terms of coverage, AM is definitely the way to go, but there's so much noise down there, and there's no bandwidth down there either, so you couldn't do your digital stuff down there.
Exactly. There's never going to be a low-power AM initiative either because there's so much competition on the AM band as it is. It's so stuffed. But
my comment was going to be that there should be the next frontier, really, with, if you've been paying, I mean, the satellite radio stuff is coming up now. I mean, the massive corporate efforts in that. And, you know, what about people banding together and try to put up a small bird, you know? And I don't know how you would get a satellite into, you know, geostationary orbit. If that's probably very difficult, but if
ham
you could get together.
Ham radio operators got the Oscar satellites up there. You know, I don't know how they did that. Did they did they pool their money together and buy these devices? I mean, those things went up in like the 60s and 70s. I mean,
sort of multinational.
I'm sorry? Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the trick, is getting your satellite geostationary.
What does it come again?
Those aren't geostationary satellites. Most of them are. I think they have some that are, but
right.
But the trick is, there's only so many geostationary slots,
right?
And who doles out those slots? The FCC. So,
whoever has money.
Right. So, coming over there. Mike?
Got the mic, I'm going
first. Okay.
You were talking about internet radio. Do you know, or does anybody here know, approximately how much bandwidth is set aside for wireless data access? I mean, is it enough to really, where that would be a significant option?
Probably not yet. Probably not yet. Because the wireless internet, it's still very new. You know, you've got these cell phones that have email capability on them. The bandwidth is pretty limited. If you're talking about like a cellular modem for your laptop, I think the cap on it is what, 14.4
at best.
Most people that have wireless modems tell me they're lucky to get 9600 baud.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you get streaming audio across a connection like that? Absolutely. Yeah, the fidelity is gonna be worse than AM radio probably, but I mean, you know, the audio compression codecs have really been improving over the last year. I mean, I remember when I first heard Real Audio 2.0, and I was like, wow, this sounds like shit. It's like Edison's first recordings, and now, I mean, what they're doing across a 28.8 pipe, the fidelity is, you know, this, you still hear the artifacts there. But the fidelity has increased so much. I'm really impressed with you know, where the compression has been going. But no, wireless internet connectivity is still such a novel idea, and it's so new. I don't think there's that much bandwidth out there yet for it. But you know, hopefully things will change soon.
One of the things I was going to comment on was actually getting a satellite up into the air. As a general rule, it can cost you, you know, 100,000, 200,000, usually more like a half a million. There's actually been a group of students at a college that managed to do it for $50,000. Got a satellite all the way up. And
yeah.
Yeah, but as far as actually putting your own up, they figured out, and NASA told them they couldn't do it. They were like, you cannot actually put it up for less than, you know, so much money. And Is it?
We're talking about not having the bandwidth for wireless data. Eventually, it'll reach the point where you'll be able to get wireless data off a satellite. If not off a satellite, off of like some sort of wireless transmitter. I mean, everyone's probably heard the schemes of having them suspended by balloons or on or on yeah, airplanes.
The,
and
yeah, the what was it that NASA just tested the aircraft that can stay aloft for like 6 months or something eventually?
They're talking about having about? Some companies are talking about having. You know, it would only be in the major markets, but having Atlanta would be one.
Yeah.
Of having a fleet of like three planes, one in the air every 12 hours.
Right.
Just circling. And they said
amazing concept.
The actual capacity, something like that, would be something like 900 communication satellites because they don't have to worry about the weight.
Exactly. You know. Exactly. And well, those things are way up there. We're talking like 100,000 feet or was it like 100 miles or something like that up there? I mean, they're almost on the edge of space. They're completely out of the flight paths of commercial air traffic. I mean, way up there. That's a few years off yet, though.
What I was going to say is almost already been covered, but the issue here is that at the frequency at which you have you know almost limitless bandwidth when you get up into the gigahertz range and you're up in 2.4, which is a relatively open band, you can do whatever you want in that range.
Right.
It's completely, chaotic. Once you get up in that range, I mean, you're talking about radio waves that are extremely line of sight. So the only
right.
way, it's not an option for broadcasting. I mean,
right.
in the traditional, you cannot broadcast at
it's
that.
It's got to be line of sight.
It's got to be line of sight. You have to have either a satellite or a plane or one of those things. So, I mean,
yeah.
that's really the only way we're going to be able to, do anything with that tremendous amount of bandwidth.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's definitely the future of broadcasting, to
yeah.
have that much space to work with and deliver, content
yeah.
that you could never imagine before.
Sure.
But, it's to do that, we're going to have to figure out some sort of, low-power way to get up there. Maybe a radio-controlled plane flying around, that can
something
support
like
itself
that.
For a long time.
Yeah, it's that is still such the limiting factor in terms of satellites. Getting a satellite up into orbit. We were talking earlier about this guy who is actually built his own rocket that he is going to ride into a suborbital into space. It's powered by hydrogen peroxide, of all things. Hydrogen peroxide at like a 90% or 80% concentration. When you push it past like a catalyst made out of silver, there's a very violent reaction and it creates steam. Well, if you funnel that out through a nozzle, you have thrust. And you can actually build a rocket that doesn't use any flame. This guy's built this rocket himself, independently. He's engineered the rocket himself. He's going to pilot it. He's going to be mission control and the astronaut. I mean, he's doing this all himself. And he's gonna do like a John Glenn or an Alan Shepard. Was it Alan Shepard that did the first suborbital? Going up and coming back down, that's no big deal. Getting something into orbit is the real trick. And a geostationary orbit is really the only thing that's useful for a communication satellite, where that satellite is always in a relatively fixed location. Like you were talking about the Oscar satellites, those are not geostationary. You can only get coverage bouncing off of them certain times, right? Oh, hold on a second. Here comes Mike with the mic.
Yeah, the only other way to do it would be if you had something like Iridium, where they had like a fleet of satellites.
Yeah, isn't that sad? I was going to comment on that. The Iridium spectrum that they basically screwed up on. They put all these satellites into orbit. For those that don't know what Iridium was, it was this huge array of satellites around the Earth so that basically you could have cellular telephone coverage anywhere on the Earth. I mean, you could be in Antarctica and pull out your cell phone and dial up. They were talking about putting these telephone kiosks, solar-powered telephone kiosks, out in the middle of the jungle, in these villages of like 500 people, and who they were going to call, I don't know. But, it was a novel idea, and the funding fell through on it, and suddenly with a geostationary satellite, these were very low orbit. you have to keep hitting the thrusters on these satellites to maintain their orbit. Otherwise, they fall back to Earth. And the company that put the Iridium satellites up there lost all of their funding, and basically they were just going to let all of these satellites that cost millions and millions of dollars just start falling back to Earth. It was like such a huge waste. Now, who took it over? Was it NASA or who was that?
I'm not even sure who did it.
It changed.
I don't even know.
Yeah, somebody picked it up, the initiative, and got the bargain of the century on these things. I mean, picked them up at pennies on the dollar for what they were placed in orbit for in terms of cost.
Musical satellites.
What's that?
Musical satellites. Since it changed hands at least 5 times.
Yeah.
Yeah. From what I heard, there were basically 2 problems with Iridium. One was that they had to drop the number of satellites in the entire constellation. I mean, they still had more or less full coverage with it, but they dropped it down. And also, and I don't know why they didn't realize this until after they'd already orbited the whole constellation, but apparently the phones didn't work indoors.
So you pretty much
had to be
these phones, by the way, had a ridiculous antenna on them that was like about 6 inches long. I mean, it wasn't like a standard, you know, cell phone where you can operate it with or without this little tiny whip antenna. It was a great big, about 1 inch wide and about 6 inch long strip. I mean, they looked really unwieldy. I mean, I'm sure you could fold the thing up, you know, when you weren't using it. But for people that are accustomed to cell phones being these tiny, tiny little things, the Iridium phones were a little bit different. But that's interesting that they didn't work indoors. And nobody tested this out ahead of time. Oh, yeah, I want to invest in a company like that.
I believe the original idea
Where do I buy stock shares in that company?
Jeez. I believe the original idea was the executive's wife or something. They didn't fully run it through marketing to make sure
it was. An even worse blunder than the Hubble Space Telescope having its mirror like 1/64,000th of an inch ground out of shape. I mean, nobody tested this ahead of time to see that these phones don't work indoors. That's just amazing.
Well, so they have entire departments that should have checked the idea, see if the business plan, see if it was sound or not. That's the tragedy.
Very tragic. But so we've touched on some of the possible alternatives to low power FM. I don't think it's ever going to happen as we had hoped a year ago. Thanks to the National Association of Broadcasters. So we're probably not going to see low-power FM ever emerge the way we had hoped to, a classic spot on the FM dial, at least not for most of us. But there are other technologies on the horizon that do hold promise. Yes, Mike, with the mic.
Question and clarification.
Okay.
Clarification on hydrogen peroxide rockets. Earlier panel said they were half the thrust, but they are a lot cheaper than conventional fuel.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If you're talking about a rocket that NASA uses, okay, the main engines on the space shuttle use liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, cryogenic fluids, which have all sorts of hazards associated with them, storage capabilities. You can't just put them in a tank and keep them there because they dissipate. They boil while they are inside. That's why you see the shuttle sitting on the pad, and there's mist leaking out of it. They have to vent this stuff out. Hydrogen peroxide, you know, it sits in the booster like that. It can sit on the launch pad for as long as you need it. And basically, all you do is you pump the. And I may be wrong here. I've only read a couple of websites on it, so I'm no expert. By any means, but the way I understand it is you have a catalyst. It's basically a screen of very pure silver inside the combustion area of your rocket. You force the hydrogen peroxide onto this catalyst, and it has a very violent reaction when it comes in contact with the silver. Well, if you have a nozzle, a bell-shaped nozzle, it produces thrust, and it's my understanding that they only produce 1/2 the thrust of a conventional liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen rocket. So,
but hydrogen peroxide is a bulk chemical.
It's very cheap. It's very cheap. To make it in concentrations like that, it's probably beyond the scope of you or I to go out and make our own distillery, you know, where we can purify hydrogen peroxide to that point. Yeah. But you know, when you're looking at the big picture, it's so much cheaper than conventional propellants.
If you're interested, my wife works in chemical supply.
Oh, really? So,
on a serious note, do you know the guy who's doing that? Is he going for the X Prize?
Is he what?
Going for the X Prize?
No, the X Prize. For those of you that don't know what the X Prize is, the X Prize is an independent initiative to put you and I into outer space. And basically, the X Prize, the reason he won't qualify for the X Prize is because the X Prize has some certain criteria. First off, the vehicle that the X Prize launches into a suborbital. Okay, they're giving I think it's a $10 million prize to the first company that can build a vehicle, launch three people into orbit, or suborbit. I'm sorry, three people into a suborbital. Come back, and within 1 week's time, they have to be able to recycle that spacecraft and have it ready to go and do another mission. And once they've done that, they win the X Prize. It's this gigantic trophy. It's like 7 feet tall, and they get like a $10 million prize. And there are currently about, I want to say, at least two dozen companies worldwide that are working on this, chasing after this. Go to xprize.org, I think is the name of the website, and you can read up more about it there. And you're going to start seeing companies in the very near future. I'm talking like within the next year or two, there are going to be amateur non-government, you know, private companies that are launching these vehicles going after the X Prize. It's a very cool initiative because it's grants like that that really fund and spearhead innovation. It emulates the early prizes that were awarded in the infancy of aviation. They gave out like prizes to Charles Lindbergh for doing the first continental flight from United States from North America to Europe. There was a cash prize for that back then. And you know, when there's money involved, it gives people the incentive to go out and do these things. And ultimately, you know, my belief is that this is going to be what gets you and I into outer space, because NASA isn't going to do it for us. they seem to be a clubhouse, an exclusive clubhouse, and you can't get into their clubhouse unless you have a membership. I could ramble on for another half hour about Dennis Tito, who has become my new personal hero, by the way. You know, the California millionaire or billionaire who rode on the Soyuz rocket to the International Space Station. Just listening to NASA just banter and kick and scream and cry, oh, he's not a trained astronaut, he's an amateur, blah, blah, blah. No, this guy was training in Russia for 6 months. For all practical purposes, he was a cosmonaut. He understood the ramifications, he went through the training, and he got the go-ahead to fly on it from the Russian Space Agency. And NASA just didn't sit well with anybody at NASA that somebody, you know, an independent citizen was purchasing a ticket up there. It's interesting to note, too, that he was a former NASA engineer, okay? So if anybody is going to understand the ramifications of going into outer space, wouldn't you think it would be one of NASA's own? So it's just ridiculous. I laughed the whole time, and I really lost a lot of respect for NASA in that whole series of events that ensued, and gained a lot of respect for the Russian Space Agency, and came to realize that, you know, when it comes to innovation in space and being pioneers, the Russians, in a lot of ways, are still way ahead of us. They're the ones willing to take these risks and do the out-of-the-ordinary things.
Probably main comment on NASA is, oh, no, I'm not the only kid that has this shiny new toy on the block anymore.
Exactly. You know, and the thing is, the Russians are partners in the International Space Station. It's partially theirs as well. Now, most of the funding and heavy lifting is coming from NASA. Okay, I'm not gonna lie about that. NASA is the one that's fitting the lion's share of the bill, but they are not the only ones that own that spacecraft. And NASA and the Russians and any other space agency, you know, as long as they have somebody who is a competent astronaut or cosmonaut, they can put whoever the hell they want up there, is my view on it. If somebody is trained and they know what's going on and what to expect, you know, why does NASA training require you to be former military and go into training for 5 years? I don't think it takes that long, you know. That's just my personal opinion.
Unless it's like a
specialized
task. I was going to say just some special gimmick like the school teacher or when they were going to put congressmen up there.
Right.
Or,
well, if you're talking about like somebody who's going to repair the Hubble Space Telescope, like Stormy Musgrave.
NASA was the first ones to put just a passenger, you know, an ordinary, try to put.
Right.
Like, just an ordinary citizen passenger into space. You know, and here they are now saying that you know, it's... You shouldn't be doing it. You know, it's totally against everything that space should be.
Yeah.
And they tried to do it 10 years ago.
How much training do you think the chimpanzees got that went into orbit? Okay. Or the dogs. Okay. They came back fine. I mean, you know, just the whole bitching and pissing and moaning. Oh, Dennis Tito is going to break something on our clubhouse up there. It was ridiculous.
It's possible that the fact that he's former NASA makes it worse.
That's probably
because they all want to be up there.
Up there,
every single person who works for NASA, even the janitor, wants to be up on the
International
Space Station.
That's why they
work
in the industry.
And they're just mad that he's got the $1 billion and can pay for it.
Yeah, it is. It's sour grapes. It's sour grapes, but. So that definitely ties into the low power FM. We're going off on all sorts of topics here. This is becoming Hacking 401. Yes, sir.
Actually, question on the digital radio. If the technical capability is there to let as many people as most communities would be possible to put radio stations, the natural response would be for the NAB to buy it all the frequencies outright.
They can't do that. There are laws on the number of radio stations that a company can own in one locality. I think you can own. Yes. I'm starting to think there are ways around that because you've got these major corporations that are.
They've changed.
Have they changed it?
Not completely necessarily. I don't think they've changed it completely, but it's heading in that direction.
Yeah,
they've already had auctions.
Well, if you've got like, you know, an infinite number of digital channels out there that are available, I don't think they're going to have the money to purchase all of them. And indeed, it would definitely appear suspicious if they did try to acquire all, you know, 20,000 or whatever, however many you know, channels you can fit on one of these internet broadcasts or wireless broadcasts. I think that would raise a few eyebrows, but. We'll wait. We'll have to take the wait-and-see approach. Yes.
There is apparently some clause in the legislation that allowed the low-bandwidth or the low-power stations in the first place.
Right.
And I wish I could remember exactly how it worked, but the bottom line is that it allows there is a group that officially, I suppose, they're a nonprofit organization that does religious broadcasting. And they're like a conglomerate.
Oh, the
and they're
coalition, Christian Radio, CRA, or something
like
that.
And
yeah.
they're actually buying up the bandwidth from other low power, from established low power stations. Uh-huh. And there's some clause that allows them to, you know, you've got your low power station, you're running fine, and then they can come in and take it from you.
If there's a loophole in the laws someplace, a lawyer will find it.
But there's a problem because they're apparently buying up all of the low power spectrum.
That's sad.
And creating their own.
Gotta love
their parishes. Every church I've ever seen has never lacked for money for rebuilding and doubling the size of their. It's like a cancer.
Folks, it's 3:25 right now. I would love to sit here and continue to chat, but I have to pee really bad. If you all want to talk amongst yourselves for the next 5 minutes, that's fine, but I'm like about to explode here. So thanks for coming.
And with that charming exit...